Okay, we're going to switch subjects a little bit, look at research on the flu, especially gain-of-function research, which has been quite controversial over the last couple of years. And there are two charges on, talk about myths and reality, which were exemplified very well here in Boston at the Boston Book Fair last week. Craig Venter, some of you know, a very famous, famous researcher, and a venture capitalist, very famous venture capitalist, were both on the same panel. And the venture capitalist made the point that we're way overregulated. We're overregulating research, especially research involving synthetic biology and genetic biology and exactly this gain-of-function stuff, and that it's killing it. It's killing research. Right? And the last question to the panel was by a woman in the audience. She said, you know, boy, I'm very worried about the research that's going on here in Boston, you know, and at these laboratories. You know, something might escape from the lab, and you know, what would we ever do about that? And to which Dr. Venter responded, "Oh, don't worry, dear." He didn't say dear. He said, "Oh, you don't have to worry. We're very highly regulated, and safety is the number one concern." So you can come on either side of this. Either we're overregulated or underregulated. It sounds like we're back in the old FDA debates, but we're going to take a quick look at what goes on here. Those of you who read Foreign Affairs, you may know the current issue, which just came out 2 days ago, has this long article by a friend and colleague, Lori Garrett, who's usually very, very good. She is very, very good, public health journalist and researcher. But this one's way over the top. This one basically argues the whole world's going to end because of a biological experiment gone bad. And that we have to get a handle on this, and the only way we're going to do this is essentially, I'm overstating her case, but not much, is essentially to merge national security with public health. And you have to put these national security agents in every laboratory, and they have to keep track of every experiment that goes on. We used to think that was impossible, but now we know with the NSA, they probably could actually do that. They may be doing that already, so we may not have to worry about that. But this question, which has been a recurrent question since 9/11, is how closely should public health work with national security? Is it still an open issue, I have to tell you. And national security people keep saying, the most recent article I read, the guy from the National Security Agency said, you know, public health is still too la-di-da about this stuff. We've got to get them to take these issues more seriously and stop worrying about poor people and start worrying about the end of the world. He didn't say it. I'm saying it. So what about the flu? And everybody, you know, you always look at 1918 and say, you know, we're going to have another major flu pandemic someday. We don't know when it is. And we should try to do everything we can do to contain the flu. And that's, you know, that's public health 101, right? Flu is a bad thing. It's something we can do something about, so we want everybody to get vaccinated. So agreeing with that, how could you ever agree with the researchers from the Netherlands and from the United States, and all funded by NIH, who want to and have already taken a flu strain that is not transmissible between humans or mammals and make it more dangerous, make it more transmissible? How could you do that? I mean, I can understand how you could do that as a researcher or even as a scientist. I can't understand how you could do that as a public health person, because all it can do is make whatever situation we have worse. And this is the analogy that everybody uses, and rightfully so, I think. It's the analogy of something horrible coming out of the lab. It's going to kill us all. This is some slides from Asilomar back in 1973 when recombinant DNA was brand new. It was just being done here in Cambridge across the river. And people said, well, you know, we have to, the scientists basically said, we're going to have a moratorium, and we'll solve the problem. And a year later, they said, we solved the problem. We have better containment, you know, P3 and P4 facilities, and we're also going to mutate, you know, use E. coli so that it'll die outside the lab. So you don't have to worry about a Frankenstein creature or whatever escaping from the lab. And we're also going to set up review panels. This is an IRB, a local IRB. And we're not going to let any research be done until a review panel has looked at it. That made everybody feel a lot better, right? And as I said, things got worse after 9/11. People started worrying about gee, you know, the end of the world is going to happen. Dick Cheney came up with his 1% solution. To remember, he said, if anything has a 1% chance to happen and hurt us, we should act like it's 100% risk and do everything, spend all our money to try to stop it. And we have the other, the millennials, the kids, now thinking that actually the goal of science is not to stop the flu or to stop horrible things, but to let you live forever. And it's not metaphorical, by the way. They actually mean it. They actually mean that we should be able to live, if not forever, for a long, long time, a lot longer than now. And they don't worry about things like the flu at all. We've seen the Better Time magazine cover a couple weeks ago. Can Google cure death? The answer is no, by the way. But that doesn't mean they won't try. They actually believe that they can get to the singularity, in which point humans will merge with robots and live forever. You laugh. No, they're actually quite serious about this. Google just hired Ray Kurzweil, who used to live in Newton, now he lives in San Francisco with Google, to figure this out, how we're actually going to do that. He wrote the book, The Singularity, as you probably know it, and he apparently was serious. The other vision of the future of science is Kurt Vonnegut's Cat's Cradle. You may remember that General Honecker was always upset because his troops had to slosh through mud, and so he asked the scientists to kind of come up with a way to make mud easier to walk through. And he did. He came up with a thing called Ice 9, which actually sucked all the liquid out of the mud and made it brittle, but it sucked all the water out of everything, including out of all the humans, and ended life on Earth. And that's, you know, an extreme Frankenstein view that scientists could, even trying to do good, could end the world. So the biggest example, again, in public health is the 1918 flu pandemic and killing 50, 60 million people worldwide. And we reenact that, not quite every year, but almost every year, with whatever new flu is available. Right? And we do get a new one, usually sometimes two or three new ones every year. And one question is, how do we convince people to get flu shots, right? I'm a public health person, you know. I think we should try to get people to do flu shots. I don't know that calling it a killer flu is something that persuades people. I do know, and I'm absolutely convinced of this, that Americans are not afraid of chickens. So, so calling it the bird flu does not engage people. All right. calling it the swine flu, you know, people get a little more upset about swine flu. They're very upset about this little child who spreads swine flu all around the country, right? So the experiments I'm talking about are these experiments with ferrets. They're cute as can be, aren't they? So a lot of the animal liberation people say you shouldn't experiment with ferrets at all. Use humans. But assuming you want to experiment with animals, and I think as I do that, that's better than experimenting with humans. The question is, what kind of experiments should we permit, and do we have any choice but to permit any experiments that scientists want to do? Certainly we have a choice of what to fund. Right? But I would say there's two categories that we've talked about at least since cloning days. Species-altering experiments, which you can alter what it means to be human. You change some of the characteristics of human. My colleague Leonard Glantz used to talk about making people all blue. That's fine, that would be a species-altering experiment, but not a species-endangering experiment. If everybody was blue, we wouldn't discriminate against blue people, right? Or we could grow wings, or whatever you want us to do. You can alter the species without endangering the species. But the second kind of experiments are really species-endangering experiments. And those, I think, I don't think you should do them myself, but we can argue about that. The question is, who's going to decide what experiment is that actually endangers the species? That puts all, like Ice 9, that puts all human beings at risk of extinction. Okay? The flu experiments, I mean, some people argue those qualify, right? To make the flu more virulent, more easily transmissible could put the entire species at risk. Probably not. I mean, you could kill hundreds of millions of people, but probably not 7 billion people. On the other hand, you don't want to do that. Public health people would say, why take the chance? I would say, why take the chance? So the second question, the hardest question, is if you really do want to have a review group, or if you want to try to not get scientists to do things that are dangerous to everybody else and could start a new pandemic, how would you do that? How would you go about doing that? And that's like a really hard question. It requires some kind of global governance. The easy thing is let the National Security Agency work with the other spy agencies around the world. They might be able to do that. The public health community, work with the scientists? Maybe. I mean, that I think is our greatest hope. And it has been suggested by others, and I'll suggest it too, that scientists should take like a Hippocratic oath to do no harm and agree among themselves as a community. They're not going to do experiments that they believe could put the human species at risk, including these ferret flu experiments. So again, to finish with Craig Venter, who likes it both ways. He doesn't want to be regulated, but he would also tell you he's so regulated now that you just shouldn't have to worry about all the new things that he's going to create in his lab. Those both can't be true. What is true is we're just starting to try to figure out how to regulate what's called synthetic biology. And we don't know how to do it. So mostly what we're doing is relying on the people who are doing it to be transparent and open. With Craig Venter, you got no problem. He's totally transparent. He wants everybody to know everything he's doing all the time. I totally get that. But he's hardly the exemplar for the world. And the tough problem, myth or reality, whether you think we're overregulated or underregulated, we've got a long way to go to figure out how to do this. The closest we've had so far in this country is the President's Bioethics Commission. But basically, they said, go slow. that we shouldn't regulate because the government doesn't know how to regulate. And so that adds to the long list that we have now, what the government doesn't know how to do. But whatever the government knows how to do, the only point is that this is not just a U.S. effort. It's got to be an international effort. And this is a big enough problem that we actually do need to worry about it and regulate it. It cannot be true that scientists from the Netherlands can develop a new flu strain that can put people in China and India at risk without people in China and India having anything to say about it. Okay, thank you. We do a couple questions before we get to the First Amendment. Did you all get your flu shot? Yes, sir. Well, the only group that can is one that doesn't have the resources to do it, which is the World Health Organization. I mean, it's one that is actually sponsored, if you don't use that term loosely, by almost 190 countries. There's nothing else like that in the world. So it would have to be, at least in the near future, the World Health Organization. So as Lori Garrett argues, actually, she argues that that's the one to do it too, but that they can't do it unless the U.S. finances it. And her argument is we should give them like $500 million for the next 5 years to do this. And it's not the world's worst idea. No, I actually urge you to read her articles. It's not. You know, whether you agree with her conclusions or not, she makes a pretty good case that we're ignoring this issue, and it's a mistake.